Welcome to the Life in the Stocks podcast, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Matt Stocks. I'm the host, and the show features unedited, in-depth, candid conversations with a wide range of musicians, actors, comedians, and creatives. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to Life in the Stocks on your favorite podcast platform. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and indeed all major podcast platforms. Be sure to give me a follow on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as well, at Matt Stocks DJ. That way you can keep up to date with all of my live Q&A dates, my DJ performances, and of course, who's coming up on the show as well. But without further ado, let's crack on with the show, shall we? Here we go.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
She called me up on a sly. She said, please don't tell all your friends, because they might tell my husband, and then you know I'll never see you. You know he'll probably wanna beat you, and I'm sure he will be beat you. So I call you on a sly. Please don't ask us, you know.
What's you see going me? On? Yeah, I can see you. I can hear you. You're looking and sounding good, Vic.
All right, good.
How are you?
I'm good. I've been a little groggy since the end of the tour.
Yeah, well, you were chatting to me at 4 a.m. your time. Is that regular for you, or are you just still in that kind of tour brain?
That's my normal. That's my normal scenario, usually.
Is it? Are you very much a creature of the night, are you?
I am.
Dude, where are you right now? Paint the scene for people listening, because that looks like the ultimate musician's man cave where you are.
Oh, well, actually, I'm at a friend's house who happens to have the ultimate hangout for me. There's really? Record players and guitars and all sorts of great stuff. So I'm like, you know, crashing on the couch and having a blast, eating food, sleeping all day. It's great.
Well, I had a really good time hanging with you on the boat, man. And there's so much I want to talk to you about today. But just out the gate, I want to say, I think I said something to this effect to you one night on the ship. But there's something about what you guys bring that's so plugged in to the tradition of ska and of American music. You know, there's many bands that do a kind of a contemporary take, and it's only a contemporary take well. What you guys do is a contemporary take on a traditional form, and you're really plugged in to the history and the lineage of it. And watching you guys live, you know, you're a real band's band, and it's evident that playing live is where you guys truly exist and thrive. And it just shines. It just comes across in the live show. You know, your sets are more of an event and a happening and a kind of a moment in time that will never be repeated. You know, like, I doubt there's ever been two Slackers shows that are the same ever. And you've obviously done hundreds.
Mm. No, we don't. We definitely don't stick to a script. It's not a, I mean, if there's some guys in the band that like to do things that are rehearsed, you know, that they're like, hey, we make sure we rehearse it. And then there's guys like me that are willing to kind of throw it to the, like, you know, see what the cards deal, you know? But that's good. It's true. There's not a script. We don't follow a thing too much, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's for me, the live music environment should be spontaneous, and it should be unique to that one place and time and that moment.
Yeah, totally. Totally. You know? And the thing is too, you got to trust. I mean, we trust ourselves with the, like, I mean, you were saying, you can hear that we've studied a lot. So there's a lot of things that we know that, hey, if we screw it up today, it doesn't mean it wasn't for lack of practice. You know, it's like a lot of times it's just, yeah, it's the luck of the draw. You screw up and you go, well, okay, I'll try to do better tomorrow, you know?
Yeah. Well, sometimes mistakes make it, you know, memorable. I think that. I feel that. Mm. I'd rather see a band be honest and raw up there than, you know, phoning it in with some pre-rehearsed, tried and tested formula.
I know. That's my taste also. I know that not everyone agrees with that. That's one of those things that I learn as I go along. You know, sometimes I'm like, oh, look at that. That band really, like, they seem like it's a little out of the box. And people will say, oh, but that's what's great. I mean, they're just so tight and it's all well thought out and planned. Yeah, it's good. Different taste, you know. The Slackers, we study a lot and we're very critical of ourselves, you know, in rehearsal and songwriting and making a record. But we also know that the great thing about live music is that it's spontaneous. It just, you know, it clicks. Some magic happens. The audience is a part of that, where they're all in on it, you know, because they make us play better, you know?
Yeah. Did you have a good time on the boat? I had an absolutely amazing time watching you guys, especially that daytime afternoon pool deck set. That was just the best.
We had a good time, I got to say. I kept myself really busy because the only other time that I did that Flog and Molly tour, I found myself, you know, really antsy. And I need to have activity, you know? So I kind of like, I signed up for everything I could possibly do.
Well, I got to see you and Marcus and Warren doing the innuendo bingo. And that was just genius. My friend Annie hosted that. And that was amazing. What a riot. And just the chemistry up there, like, you know, you and Marcus and Warren, obviously very different energies together. It just worked.
Yeah, it was bizarre.
She did a great job of shepherding all the madness.
I was happy that Marcus was there. That was really more of a Marcus. That was where his talents can really shine, you know. And Warren, forget about it. I had no idea. Like, Warren is just like, yeah,
he's a unique dude, isn't he? Had you never met or spent time around him before that cruise then?
No, I didn't realize he was such a mad genius. Like, that's really.
He's like a savant. You know, he's way out there. He's a brilliant illustrator, an incredible musician and songwriter, and just as a performer. Did you get to see him when they were playing, when the Vandals were playing on the last night? He jumped off the stage with his kind of cordless mic, went to the back of the boat, got in the hot tub with everyone, started singing Queen. I was like, this guy is amazing.
Yeah, I was impressed with that. I thought, wow, this is like, yeah, he really is the guy. I always knew that he was the kind of like clown prince of the Vandals. That was a pretty spectacular performance. That one, that was the best.
Wasn't it just, I want to talk to you all about New York, if that's all right, mate. I am fascinated with the history of that city. Whenever I have anybody from New York on the show, I always try and, you know, get their whole timeline, as much as you want to go into. I'm presuming you were born, Ray, is like your entire worldview, personality, taste in music, friendship circles, like everything is kind of formed and forged in and around New York. Is that safe to say?
Yeah. Yeah. That's my origin story.
Where were you initially raised? Where were the early formative years spent?
Well, I'm born in the Bronx in a kind of an old, the northeast part of the Bronx that had been an old Italian, Irish, and Jewish neighborhood, where they all met. Actually, these neighbors, they all met, and I lived right kind of at a meeting point between all those neighborhoods. And so it's a very old school New York, you know, era that doesn't really exist to that level anymore. A lot of those immigrant groups, you know, kind of got on their feet, moved to the suburbs. And my family, you know, did the same at some point, a lot of them. And Yeah, it's part of like my old school. I have a bit of the old school New York that exists from the outer boroughs, you know. And then as soon as I could, I moved down to Manhattan because that's where everything was going on. You know, I remember like watching Sesame Street and stuff, you know, and thinking like, hey, you know, I guess everybody's looking at New York, you know. I better like take advantage of what I've been given, you know.
How old were you when you made that move?
I moved down at about 17, I think. Yeah. And I was going to school. I was doing a couple of things. You know, I graduated high school like early and stuff. So I ended up in Manhattan. Yeah, just at about the right time. And that was like late 80s. Yeah, late 80s. So I got to catch some really of the remnants of the cool old New York punk scene, like some of the original guys all hanging out. It was cool, you know, to touch it, you know.
They were still around, were they? Because late 80s, you know, I imagine obviously kind of like late 70s, early mid 80s, there's all, as you say, the amazing punk stuff happening. You've also got hip hop exploding.
Oh, yeah.
As it gets towards the end of the 80s and you're arriving, what is the overall mood and what are the acts that are still there and kind of making waves and the characters, man? Because as you say, like in the 80s, there would have still been people like Lou Reed and Warhol and all those cats just hanging around, I presume, and Basquiat. And
yeah, totally. Totally. Well, that's the thing is like, so I guess from the mid 80s, when I started going down to see shows, like while I was still in high school, right, I'd go down, see gigs, poke my head around. That was still the golden age of the hardcore scene really kicking in. So that was my entree. And then, once I was hanging around and I actually had time to poke my head around, it's amazing how many of those guys would just literally, like, I'd go to a bar to see a band, and I'd be standing next to, like, Jerry Nolan from the New York Dolls, or I'd see Cheetah Chrome drinking in a bar, or Allen Ginsberg was everywhere. Like, you couldn't get away from Allen Ginsberg. Like, he was just everywhere in the city that I went. So much so that I really took it for granted. And when I realized how cool that was and who he was, like if that happened now, I would freak out. But back then it was just like, oh, Ginsberg again, like, come on, like what's he doing? You know, guy's crazy, you know?
I guess he would have been completely enamored with the punk scene, right? Cause for me, there is a direct timeline between the Beats and the hippies and then the punks, you know, although sometimes punks like to say, you know, fuck hippies, we're very different. I think it's all the same, isn't it? It's all kind of about expression and self-empowerment and, you know, trying to make positive change and being yourself and all of these things. And it did kind of go Beats, hippies, punks. And it's all sort of the same, isn't it? It just takes on different manifestations.
Yeah, actually, one of the cool movies, I don't know if you can find it anywhere. It was called Gang of Souls. And Gang of Souls was a really cool interview movie where they connected, a lot of the punks connected themselves to the Beat generation. And so guys like Henry Rollins, Lydia Lunch, you know, those kind of guys in particular, they saw themselves as like a continuation of that vibe, you know?
Patti Smith, obviously.
Patti Smith, yeah. It opened my mind to a lot of stuff and also to a lot of poets, like a lot of guys that I didn't realize were just in my midst, like guys like Gregory Corso or who's the guy? He actually lived down the block from me, John Giorno. John Giorno, who I always meant to like ring his doorbell or write him a postcard or something and just say, hey, you know, big fan, curious, you know, and I was always kind of too nervous to do it, you know, like some of these things I really regret, like I could have made better connections than I did, but still I was in the midst, you know, you were in the mix of everything and it was really cool, you know.
Do you know Jesse Malin? Are you two friends?
Yeah, I know him. Over the years we crossed paths a bunch, and of course he's the owner, him and what's his name, the other guy from that band, were owning Niagara and Coney Island High and a couple of other places that we played regularly, you know. I mean, Niagara is kind of a meeting spot, a meeting spot. You know, people DJ there. But Coney Island High was really important to us. It was a place right on St. Mark's Place. And it was really at a kind of a crux, you know, like at a spot where everybody crossed paths, everybody met. So we used to play a lot of shows over there. It was almost like the wetlands that happened in the East Village. We had these two venues that really mattered. And Wetlands was probably the most important of all of them, just because it was exactly what you're talking about, the meeting place of hippies, punks, and just pretty much every other freak that was interested in something. Reggae scene was there. Hip hop was there. It was righteous. It had environmental causes in its roots. It was very cool. And I think we didn't realize, again, we didn't know how spoiled we were to have this sort of place, you know, these kind of places that were encouraging us, you know, and letting us play, you know?
Yeah, I guess as well, everything was so affordable at that point in time.
Yeah, it certainly was.
So you could be an artist and just develop your craft and not have to worry about, you know, extortionate living costs. And I guess as well, there was, you know, changes in like, just like local laws. And was it Giuliani was the name of that mayor that kind of introduced a lot of you know, impositions on creative expression, putting it kindly, and it changed the city a lot, right?
Well, there was a movement, and there'd been a movement for years to kind of clean the city up. I mean, a lot of the things that we, I have a friend of mine that's a sociologist, and he reminds me that the city was designed to be more like it is now than the way we fell in love with it. You know, we fell in love with New York at a time that it was going through a depression. It was seriously underpopulated. The economy was a wreck. And people didn't want to live there. And so, you know, folks like me just thought it was the best idea to go there immediately. Bam, right there. Everybody you wanted to know was going to be there. And it kept all the riffraff out. People were afraid to be there that weren't cool enough, or that were freaked out by crime, or, you know, things that didn't freak.
The lunatics had taken over the asylum.
Yeah. You know, things that don't freak artists out, like, you know, crime, poverty, you know,
drugs,
disease. So I didn't realize I was as much as of one of those people as I am. And, the generations that preceded me, when I watched a couple documentaries, like I watched this Downtown 82 movie, and I was like, oh my God, it's like, you know, these guys were really pioneering in some spots. Yeah, that were tough. You know what I mean? Like, you know, empty buildings, no electric. I mean, we lived in squats too. I had a lot of time and a lot of friends that lived in squats. I spent a lot of time in squats, even though I generally just lived in a regular crowded apartment with four or five people, you know? It was really something else. It was really something else. I miss that insanity.
Yeah. I mean, even for me as a young kid growing up, I'd watch Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. And that was my introduction to New York, was movies like that. And then through the John Hughes films, I'd see Chicago in a similar light. You know, and they always seem to be these kind of terrifying, but also really exciting places where, you know, there was criminals and artists coexisting.
Yeah.
And like danger and excitement around every corner.
We didn't realize it, you know. I think when we saw those movies and stuff, it always looked very, it was like, oh yeah, cool. Well, this is how we're perceived outside, or. Like, oh, look at that cheeseball, you know, version of this or that. And I realize now how, some of it, I just didn't realize what was going on. Yeah, it was definitely weird. I'm not sure that I would walk right into that now. You know, I think you had to be a bit young and stupid, and it makes you feel this, you know? But then again, no, you know, no, nobody really cared about us. One of the things I like about crappy neighborhoods is that, you know, you get to be invisible. Like the cops aren't looking at you. Nobody cares if you throw a party or have a recording studio or if you're loading stuff in and out of a place in the middle of the night. Nobody notices. Nobody says anything. You know, they're kind of like, oh, something's going on over there. Let's like, don't look, you know?
Yeah, it's not worth the paperwork.
Yeah. It helps. It helps a lot. And I mean, and that, but that also goes for the people like that are around, like the neighborhood kind of reflects that also. People look out for each other. People turn a blind eye to some things and not to other things, you know? You can trust that, you know, people might be looking out for your van. They like you. They go, hey, I like this guy with the van, you know? Hey, oh, you guys are the ones that move the guitars in and out of the alleyway late at night. But we know it's you guys. You know, if they see somebody else doing it, they go, hey, what are you doing? You know?
I love that. Yeah, that, well, that's real community, isn't it? That's what that is. Real community. Yeah. What about cinema and stand-up comedy? Because, you know, for me, that kind of time period conjures up like Jim Jarmusch, Spike Lee, a great kind of, you know, independent filmmaking scene. And then you had, obviously, juggernaut comedians like Andrew Dice Clay, and you know, New York at that point seemed to, not just music, but like everything was so culturally vibrant and exciting. Were you into other stuff, or was it always just music for you?
Nah, you couldn't avoid being surrounded by things. So like, you know, there was a lot of movies happening. I mean, I think one of the things that a lot of my friends knew about was that Kids movie.
Yeah, right.
And the Kids.
Of course, yeah, great film.
Yeah, that happened. There was always great movies, great art theaters.
Was that Harmony Korine?
Harmony
Korine, is that who made Kids? And Larry Clark.
Yeah. I wasn't too hip to that scene, but I knew a lot of people that were into that, and they were like poking their heads around. I mean, even people that knew, I mean, they were just kids that literally they were like, nobody was a professional actor, you know? And there was a lot of that. I mean, I didn't realize that we were just, again, we were surrounded by a lot of talent at that moment. I just thought that's what the world looked like. Mm. You know, I thought everybody just played instruments and had cool bands and, you know, made a movie or got in a movie or was in a theater or lived across the street or upstairs from a great theater. It was just everywhere, you know, and I mean, everything from Shakespeare to avant-garde, you know, weird ass stuff like, you know, a New Eureka Cafe that just closed recently, you know, poetry. I mean, it was really, yeah, it was full. So much so that now I wish I could go back. I would do a lot more than I did. You know?
Did you do a lot of documenting? Did you take photos or, you know, record stuff out and about, or were you just too busy living it, being in it?
Yeah, we didn't have, you know, cell phones with cameras back then and recorders. So
Yeah.
No, the way I processed it was through what I did. You know, I made myself part of it. And, you know, I always carry a notebook. So I have a lot of notes in my pocket. I wrote a lot of things down. And probably if I look back, I find a lot of funny stuff, you know, documents in that way, you know. I was kind of a beatnik before I knew what the beatniks were, you know. People would say like, hey, you know, you should check this thing out. You should do this thing. I'm like, well, what do you mean? Like, I don't know. These guys? Like,
well, there's something
then I started
Go on, Vic. Sorry.
No, I mean, it was only later on that I started to really appreciate them, because I realized that I was like, oh, wow, this really reverberates with me and my friends. Like, this really feels like us. And wow, people make a big deal out of these guys. And I thought, weird. Like, you know, cool. Maybe somebody will make a big deal out of us. I don't know, you know?
Well, you guys seem to be a kind of a stepping stone between that old, you know, scene that we've just been talking about and then what came.
Yeah.
Because obviously, you know, were you always doing ska? Was the Slackers always like a ska band from its, you know, inception? Because at that time, there wasn't really any bands doing that sort of thing, was there really? You'd had the two-tone movement, and that had been amazing and left its mark. But the 80s, kind of the tail end of the decade, and certainly the early years of the 90s, there weren't any like real popular ska bands, were there?
No. I mean, we had a ska scene in New York that I found out about while I was in high school. And it was kind of, it was a kid scene. It was a high school kid scene. Somehow they were having a scene. To tell you what New York was like, they were having a fully active scene of all high school kids, and all the shows were in bars. So there were bars that were dedicated to certain high schools where everybody would go hang out, watch a show. You know, these were just, nobody ever got ID'd. There was never a worry that I'm not going to be able to get in this show because I don't have a fake ID or something. You know, but that middle of the 80s ska scene, there was a few really good bands. And then there was some of the bands that would become kind of like, they were the predecessor of the 90s kind of goofball, playing too fast kind of band. You know, in my opinion, that's my opinion. But that all died out and they all became funk bands. They all got a little popular. They decided they would play, you know, yeah, something funky, or they would try to make their mark in R&B and get a record contract, and they all just kind of disintegrated. And there was like maybe one or two bands left. I think there was the one band I would see was called the Scofflaws. And when
they
I saw
have
the Scofflaws,
records, could you listen to their music, or were they more of just a live band?
No, Scofflaws had no recordings at that time. It took him about till the 90s, maybe mid 90s to make a record, I think. Early 90s, maybe. But at that time, no, you just saw them in a club, you know? I remember the first time I saw them, I was like, wow, this is cool. Like, there are punks. There's skinheads, which at the time I had only known from the hardcore scene. But dressed kind of cool. They look kind of weirder than I'd ever seen skins look, you know, with their funny plaid shirts and things. I was like, what is this? And then a whole other element that looked like some other thing I had never seen, which was guys wearing suits and trench coats and girls hanging out, which was like pretty much the deciding factor that I was going to come back. And they were all dressed like, you know, like 60s, like Twiggy and like, you know, Agent 99 from Get Smart, you know, like I was like, look at this. This is great. And so, yeah, the ska scene attracted me both musically and stylistically. I felt like, oh, I could really hang out here, you know? They were even nice to punks, you know?
There's something that annoys me about the perception of ska today. Because of the aforementioned goofy bands you alluded to there, you know, it's very popular and it's very easy to ridicule ska as this silly, you know, thing. But it's like, you need to listen to the Specials and Toots and the Maytals and like actually understand that ska music is essentially like soul music and punk music combined. It's socially conscious. It's got a positive message. It's intelligent, but it's also fun. It's about unity, it's about love, and like all of the things that it represents to me is a world away. Although I do enjoy the music of the more silly bands, I definitely do, and they were my gateway into it all. Ska for me is like, if you don't like ska, you don't like music, as far as I'm concerned, because I'm like, what's not to love about that music?
Well, that's what Two Tone said, right? They said if you don't dance to this, then you don't dance, right?
I've never heard that. That's amazing, but it sums it up right there, didn't it? Nail on the head. How can you not?
That was a big part of the music for me too, was that it was dance music. It was something that you could get in the crowd, and it wasn't a mosh pit. You know, which I certainly enjoyed and I still enjoy. Like, you know, punk was my savior when I was a teenager, and I really like was so happy I found it. It did a lot for me that nothing else could. But man, when I found ska and reggae, I was like, wow, you could really like people are dancing to this. And then the idea that I could be in a band that would make people dance and connect in that way. And then you could go out, you could still be kind of a wild hooligan character, but you could like do it with some style, bring a little, you know, a little extra cool to it. I was like, wow, this is just like, this is perfect, you know? On top of it, I've been a blues fan since I'm a young kid. You know, I around 10 or 12 years old, I found blues. And my mom loved doo-wop and Motown. I mean, I had all this music around me. And I find that all reflected, like you're saying, I find that reflected in ska and reggae, like completely. It's the same music, basically, you know, just with a slightly different emphasis, you know?
How do you go about finding other people with the same tastes and vision and dream? Because that's, I think, the hard thing about forming a band that has, you know, more than, say, four members, like a lot of traditional rock and punk groups do, is you've got all the horns and everything else as well. There's a lot of different elements to juggle. How do you go about, you know, sourcing kindred spirits at a time when there's not a lot of them around? Was it just on the scene? You'd be like, there's one other guy, he looks like me, I'm going to approach him.
I don't know, it was weird. I mean, and this is again why I feel like it was a fortunate time to be in New York. You know, there was a lot of people hanging around. I don't think guys even knew, like, guys that joined the Slackers weren't joining a band because they wanted to be in a ska band. They just wanted to be in a band. And we looked, I mean, it was all friends of friends, you know? It was like, oh, I know a guy that plays guitar. Let me ask him. Oh, I met this guy. He knows one of the bands that he likes, Fishbone, for example, you know? And I, also, that was underground music. It's like, okay, cool, this guy. Well, oh, this guy knows the Specials. He's a Specials fan. I saw him wearing this jacket, you know, and I was like, hey, talking to him. Yeah, everybody found each other, you know, like, and it was underground enough that it was cool. You know, you still had to kind of be initiated into the flock, you know. There wasn't a lot of preconceptions about it either. You were kind of making it as you found it, you know? And who didn't like Motown? I mean, Motown, Stax, you know, this kind of music, even if I didn't know all of it, I would hear the new stuff. I'd, wow, this is great. Somebody play me something that they found. When we got our horn players, Dave and our old trumpet player, Mush, they were kind of our, like, reggae, you know, music source. They had all these old records and they kept bringing rock steady records and old ska and like heavy kind of, you know, DJ chatters. And, you know, it was a real education. We were learning as we went and we just thought, this is just great stuff, man. It's like a never ending well of material, you know, like you could just dig right into it, and it's great, you know?
Yeah. And then as the 90s kind of like progress and evolve, New York then becomes this really kind of varied scene, doesn't it? You've got like Swans and Sonic Youth and then obviously John Spencer Blues Explosion and all that kind of stuff. Like, you know, avant-garde music seemed to take over and rise. And did you sit in pretty well with all of that? Did the Slackers kind of have a natural home within that scene, or were you still sort of like a bit of an island to yourselves as the kind of alternative generation, you know, rose to prominence?
Yeah, we were always alternative, even to the alternative.
The alternative really to the alternative.
Yeah, we didn't really fit many places. I mean, I guess when like I'm trying to think, they used to be right before, like, I suppose right at the time that I showed up, there were these matinee shows that would happen at CBGB's. And everybody knows about the hardcore matinee on Sundays. But on Saturdays, there was a ska matinee. And that was where a lot of the people that I met that were from the older scene, that's where they all knew each other from. And different bands would come in from different towns. And, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of bands playing ska or anything. And then CBGB's was also kind of, it had gone to the avant-garde. There wasn't even a lot of punk bands playing at CB's anymore. You know, I would go stand outside and listen to bands and, you know, hope that I could sneak in or get in for cheap as the set got you know, further on into the set, they'd cut the price of the ticket. But bands like Dinosaur Jr., for example, like they would be playing, or be like Luna Chicks, or there was a band called Karen Black, like the it was called, like, I don't know, the Fantastic Horror of Karen Black. There was a lot of bands, and they were all these different directions. You know, some of it was rock, some of it was avant-garde. There was a lot of noise music, you know. There was remember the Spin Doctors, right? Like,
of course, yeah.
Spin Doctors and Blues Traveler were hanging around New York at that time.
Right.
Starting their scenes, they didn't sound anything like when they had pop hits. It was almost like they were different bands. They were reinvented for the record industry. But at that time, they were playing this funk, like hippie funk, and there were punks that were playing funk that were kind of like, maybe could have been vaguely related to like what happened with the Chili Peppers.
Yeah.
But it was something else. It was, you know, there was a black punk scene that was a black punk funk scene, like 24/7 Spies and guys like that. I mean, a lot of it is just completely forgotten. It's kind of like off the rails. It's on another planet over there. And then the Slackers appeared in the midst of it. Everybody thought we were like some old guys from the 50s. They were like, what is this shit? You know? Now, what are you guys trying to do? You know?
I love it. Well, if you're out of step and out of fashion at the start, then you can never fall out of fashion, right? You can just, if you stay the course, you can continue to carve your own niche, and you're never going to fall from grace, because it's like, well, we were weird from the very start.
Yeah. Actually, we found a band in New York that was a psychedelic band. They were called the Toads.
Uh-huh.
And the Toads,
great name.
The Toads, yeah, they dressed like the Yardbirds, and they sounded like early Pink Floyd. Like somewhere between early Pink Floyd and Yardbirds, Kinks. And we found them, and we were like, oh, we're going to play shows together. Like us two, like we're good. And we tried to play as many shows as we could together. We got each other. I don't think anybody got us, you know? It was great, though. I mean, it was just great, you know? So those were up years.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
It's fascinating to me, though, because like when Rancid come along, you know, how does that story and that partnership begin? Because for me, some of the best tunes on the Life Won't Wait record, I know you had a big hand in writing. Hooligans, Life Won't Wait, Wrongful Suspicion. They were all songs that you penned, right?
Yeah. Totally.
And they're the best tunes on that album for me.
Thank you, I'm glad you like them.
Yeah, dude, as you know, I DJ and I play those songs all the time in my sets. They obviously arrive in New York and are taken by what you're doing and bring you into the mix, and use your skills to elevate their own status, perhaps.
Yeah, well, you know, it was cool because it was kind of a synchronicity. As we were bouncing around New York and then originally starting to travel a bit, we weren't going too far. I think the furthest we'd go is we'd take a ride down to Florida, you know, once or twice a year. We might go to the Midwest, bounce around. We were finding bands that we had some things in common with. And then all of a sudden, 1996 happens or whatever, and there's a two-tone song on the radio. And it's, what the hell band is this? It sounds like a weird version of the Specials. What is this?
That was Time Bomb, was it?
And that was Time Bomb, yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was kind of happening somewhere that we weren't aware of, you know? And I think they might have filmed the video in New York. So they were already kind of like a little New York, you know, fan. They were a fan of the New York look or whatever. They came in to play a show and were looking for some horn players. They wanted to have a horn player. And they ended up finding a guy that I was playing with. We were currently in an all-star group called the Stubborn All-Stars in New York. Well, we had picked all the guys that were kind of trad interested musicians and put them all together in this band that was, you know, we still hadn't really figured out how to play old school, but we were doing our best. And yeah, from that guy sitting in with Rancid, they heard our CD because he gave him a CD. And then they said, hey, why don't you guys come open for us? We're going to do a European tour. And then,
This is the Stubborn All-Stars, not the Slackers.
Yeah, Stubborn All-Stars.
Yeah.
Because Stubborn All-Stars were a bit ahead of the Slackers so far as making a record and doing things. We always thought Stubborn All-Stars was going to be the band that was the working band that we were all going to make a buck off, you know?
Right. And what happened? How come it wasn't? Just too many people wanted to do different stuff.
Honestly, I don't know. It kind of fell apart at a funny moment that it should have been doing good, and it, I don't know what happened. It kind of fell apart. But lucky enough, I had already worked my way into the Rancid bunch because having listened to their record, I noticed that they had organ on the record. And I told them, I said, hey, I noticed you got organ on the record, and I'm an organ player. And I don't see that you have an organ player with you. So if you want, you know, my services are here. I'm happy to play with you. And they were like, oh, cool, man. Yeah. And I played with them a couple times and then it became a regular thing. Then they asked me to go on tour. They asked the horn section to go on tour for a big tour. They wanted to have a big band for a couple songs, you know? And so our horn section toured with them. Yeah, we all made friends. We all musically found all these things we had in common. And then, you know, everything went from there. You know, we all ended up playing on that Life Won't Wait record, you know? So I think all of us in some form. And then through them, they introduced me to guys from the Specials. They introduced me to, you know, I got a writing credit with Buju Banton on that record. Like crazy. Like things I could have been like, what? This will never happen, you know?
Were they keen to bring you in as a songwriter fairly quickly? Like how did, you know, because obviously playing with a band is different to, you know, writing for their records. How did that segue take place? Was it like an organic one? Was it an immediate one? Were you like, hey, I've got these ideas I think you guys might like? How did they all come to be on that album?
I mean, it was pretty organic. It was, we were on tour with a couple of different festival tours. I think we did Lollapalooza was the first one. And I hung around playing a lot of, you know, I'd sit around the back playing guitar. And Tim and I would like really, we had really hit it off just as friends and like whatever. But then of course we had all this musical stuff in common. We were listening to Dylan records together, talking about the Stones, Creedence, you know, like funny stuff that you're like, oh, cool. You like this too? Cool, let's play this tune. And then at a certain point they were making demos for a new record. And I was invited to come play on the demos because they knew that I was like a kind of a jack of all trades musician. And yeah, my girlfriend at the time was working for, like, they had just started Hellcat. She had started working for them. It was kind of a family affair, you know? I went in, I played bass on the demos, mostly bass, which is kind of funny because Matt Freeman's like a much better bass player than me probably, but
he's a beast. Yeah.
But he didn't know how to play reggae, for example. Right. Like he knew a vague idea and ska and stuff. He had ideas, but I of course was studying in a way that was like the 60s and 70s style. So I was bringing this like 60s, 70s thing in. And like, you know, yeah, even my two-tone style was pretty, pretty rootsy two-tone, if you can call it that. Mm. And then I was like, you know, I got songs, man. I'm like, we want to, you know, I got a couple tunes. You want to play them? And then they just, yeah, it was very organic, very organic. Yeah, it was cool, you know?
I mean, that for me is my favorite Rancid record. I know everybody says Outcome the Wolves is the one, but I just like the variety on Life Won't Wait. And when it came time to kind of reading up about yourself in the lead up to today's chat, I was like, I can't believe this dude has done like my three favorite songs on that album. So yeah, dude. And it makes sense to me, having seen, you know, the Slackers live and seeing like your vibe, those three tunes are, you know, it's the Slackers vibe, isn't it? Like, that's kind of what you guys do better than anyone.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was a lot of things that I could do. There was a lot of things I was interested in doing that even, you know, the Slackers weren't doing. We had already decided to stick to a more 60s vibe. We were going to try to recreate a 1960s sound with our own songwriting that would obviously be influenced by the moment. Like, when I listen to my songwriting now, I hear that I coexisted with bands like Nirvana, for example. You know, there's no doubt. Like, we were coming from the same era of writing. It's just that they went one way. They chose to sound like, you know, whatever grungy sound.
Yeah.
And then we chose to go backwards, and we liked, you know, I like that lush kind of groovy sound of the 60s. And but I noticed that the songwriting, you know, we were all writing songs of this era. You know, there's a certain way of phrasing things and chord progressions that are not just typical blues progressions, always throwing a weird chord in there somewhere, you know. And so I brought that to the Rancid guys, and I think they heard, they were like, hey, that's cool. I like that. That's a weird change. Like, let's use that. And then we would take turns writing verses, because obviously my voice, my lyrical voice is not the same as Rancid. They have a certain lyrical sense.
Yeah.
So maybe I'd get a verse in there, or I'd get a chorus or whatever, and they'll kind of weave in and out. But those guys really, you know, they obviously have a certain lyrical style, you know?
Yeah, they're all about the street, aren't they? And kind of the underground scene.
Celebration
of punk culture. That's very much what Rancid do very well.
Yeah.
And it's
totally
interesting, because your lyrics for State House, as your version is called, a lot more political. It's nice to hear that version. That was on like the second latest record you put out, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's on the latest full length that we did. Or maybe it was on the, I don't know. We've released it in a couple of versions now, just cause we had a couple of opportunities. But that's a great example. Like, so I had that idea, and it was a story that was happening at the time, right? That must have been 2000. No, that was 98. 98, I think it was. And so there was that story, it was in the news about the Capitol building flying the Confederate flag, and people were pissed off about it, you know, because there was kind of a mini, you know, if you want to call it a BLM or some sort of a civil rights, you know, there was a kind of a black civil rights moment happening in the late 80s and early 90s that was still going. People were still aware of this. And I remember reading that and going, man, that is something like that's a tune. You know, and I came up with this riff and this basic song. And my verse was really political. And then they kind of went wider with it, like into all these crazy, like kind of conspiracy theories and, You know, actually things that the punks owned back then. We owned conspiracy theories back then, you know. It wasn't right wing yet.
Yeah, that's an interesting shift, that is. And they shout out all the bands, don't they? They're, you know, shouting out all the New York bands and bands that they've met through the New York scene in the Rancid song. What's the deal with at the end? He says, Marky, go get your shine box. What's all that about?
That was a joke. We were on tour with the Ramones. And Marky Ramone became really tight with Lars particularly. And they had a joke of, they had a joke with the Goodfellas. Hey, you know, go get your shine box, you know? And it was just kind of their little catchphrase, you know?
Because obviously it's a diss in Goodfellas. And I was like, they can't be dissing Marky Ramone, surely. But yeah, it's an in-joke. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, because he would be like, you know, they would be like, all right, I'll see you on stage, you know, whatever. Hey, have a good night, all right, you know? And it'd be like, hey, Lars, hey, don't forget your shine box, all right? You know? Like, well, you know, New York is, the good thing about New York is that we're ball busters in a very friendly way. And
absolutely,
I would say that Rancid, not all of them, but I'd say half of Rancid has got a really good ball busting sense of humor that is very simpatico with my personality.
That half even being though, Lars and Matt.
I think so, definitely. Yeah, but definitely even I get close to crossing the line. I've definitely crossed the line with them. And I had to learn that, like, okay, not everybody has this asshole sense of humor that New Yorkers do, you know. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because when you become more successful and you rise the tides of the music industry, you do come into contact with people who take themselves very seriously, perhaps when they should not, because, and I'm not talking about Rancid here, but like, you know, a lot of bands are so pretentious and think that it's also, you know, precious and important. And you're like, lighten up a bit, dude. Like it's rock and roll. It should be fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's for sure. And I think you find the higher up you go, the cooler, the bigger the bands get, the nicer the people get. Like they have less to prove. They've been there. They've done it. You know, and I was definitely in a kind of that was the beginning of my professional career at that time. So I certainly found myself outgunned a lot of times and feeling a bit, you know, nervous and intimidated by a lot of people, you know, only to learn that, like, yeah, like the guys in Devo ended up being the nicest guys I would meet, you know, that you could sit around with the Ramones and, like, you know, eat potato chips. And, you know, it was just like, oh, okay, you guys are actually really nice people. Like, I'm not getting any rock star bullshit from you guys, you know. But I certainly was nervous a lot of times. And I probably put my foot in my mouth just trying to be funny. You know, I didn't realize that people, yeah, not everybody is really, you know, not everybody comes from this East Coast, you know, asshole sense of humor thing. And it really is just, it's just like, sometimes I imagine, I think, oh my God, did I say that? Like, how could I have said that to anyone in the world? You know, it's just a human thing, you know? And then
it comes
you get back
a place of love. It comes from a positive place. As you say, it's like cross signals, isn't it? Some people are just like, what the hell did that guy just say?
Yeah. Well, because it's because when you're trying to make friends with somebody and you really feel like you're making friends, you can push their buttons and see how far you can go. Because it's kind of a test of trust. It's like, well, do you trust me? I mean, like, tell me, do you really think I'm that much of an asshole? You know, and like, you know, how thick is your skin? Like, let's see what you got. And it's a way to kind of lovingly, you know, poke at each other. And I don't think that every culture has that. I know, I definitely see it in England. I mean, England is amazing when it comes to that. It's like,
and Scotland, you know, even more so. If you've spent much time up there, they absolutely love it up there. They're the kings of ball busters up in Scotland. But you go to like a Glasgow pub, there's no way.
Oh my God.
If, especially as an American, there's no way they're not going to absolutely rib you. But again, it will be from a place of love and they'll be testing you. And if you can take it and you respond well,
absolutely,
then you're immediately in.
Right. And then it's like, okay, you're in, you're cool. We got this. You know, now we got this. It's like, oh, you always want to be in a gang with guys that are tougher than you, you know, or in a band with musicians that are better than you. You want to be like, okay, you know, make me live up to my potential, you know? You know, I mean, in a, I suppose that's a beautiful way to think about it. You know, I want to make sure my gang is tougher than me, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you elevate yourself that way, don't you? You're only as good as the company you keep.
Absolutely.
So what time in the series of years unfolding do you kind of like remain in the Rancid camp until and then kind of go your separate ways? And is it all amiable? Does it just kind of run its course?
Yeah, I think it kind of ran its course naturally. After we did Life Won't Wait, Rancid kind of felt like they had to reinstate their punk, you know, ethos or whatever. People were like, oh, what kind of record is this, you know? I mean, because they were really doing a lot of experimenting. They had written a rockabilly song. They have that, you know, they had done all sorts of things. They were really pushing it. And I thought that was really cool because they were more like The Clash.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was like their Sandinista album, wasn't it?
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, the Slack is being part of that world. We were pushing our envelopes in all different directions, too, getting really busy. But they kept asking me to come back. I think they asked me to come back for 3 more records after that. I did Indestructible. I did Let the Dominoes Fall and maybe something else I did.
Oh, wow. So you were basically in the mix right up until Kevin started working with them from the Interrupters. And then I guess
he started doing
what you were doing with all the keys and everything else.
And the Slack has got so busy that it just became ridiculous. It was like, well, the Slackers are my main thing and I'm just going to be busy doing this. I had fun with Rancid. I don't think anything was weird about it. I did the Transplants little thing with them.
Did you?
That wasn't really my style. And I think that's when I realized that Tim and I were kind of like, our tastes were kind of parting. And it was like, okay, cool. He's going off in some other direction. A bit more hip hop. He always had that hip hop kind of vibe. Mm. And then the Slackers had really defined themselves. And it was one of those weird moments too, where I realized, you know, I mean, I certainly had the offer to be in the band, you know? And it was a strange thing to be like, you know, I'm not sure I can give myself to another band. I think I got to be in the Slackers. You know, and maybe some people would say that that's a really stupid idea, like particularly other professional musicians I've spoken with about it. Well, like, man, you did what, you know? And I'm like, I'm sorry, man. It's my personality. My personality is like, I got to be me, you know? And after that, I think I had to own it. Like, okay, I'm in my late 20s, early 30s, whatever. I know what I like and I know what I want. And I'd rather be a little, you know, I'd rather be the captain of my own small ship, you know, than the mate on somebody else's ship.
I hear you, man. And I back that. And I'm the same. You know, I think that integrity is everything. And it really does. You get to sleep sound at night and you get to look at yourself in the mirror and back yourself, right? Knowing that you had that chance to go for the money. And it would have been fun and you would have enjoyed success, but it wouldn't have been yours. And you would have kicked yourself, I think, down the line and gone, fuck, man, I really wish I'd put in more time and energy with my thing, because who knows what could have been. And you don't want to live that way, do you, where you go, what if?
Yeah. Yeah, you can't do that. I mean, I knew that from, that's the way I got into the music. You know, it wasn't like I was, you know, I had already taken a lot of chances. And the guys, it's also loyalty, you know. My band is still my band from way back. Like, they're still the guys that started it with me. And, they've been through a lot of ups and downs. They trust me, you know, for better or worse, you know. They put a lot of trust in me. And that was part of the story, too, you know.
You guys have great camaraderie, and it shows and shines on stage, man. Again, it's like you can see you're a real band. There's real trust and love and enjoyment, most importantly, you know, because again, it can be the case that you go see a band who's been together for a long time and you can see with the stiffness of their movement and even in their eyes that they're doing it because it's now at this point in their life the only way they can really make money. So they're resigned to go out and play with these schmucks that they've been playing with all these years that they in some cases probably can't stand the sight of. or can just about tolerate. But then you see bands like you guys, and there's plenty of other examples that just still love it and are still brothers, mm-hmm. and are just like, you know, come rain or shine, we're in this together and we're going to have a damn good time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's a beautiful thing. The guys are with, we're all together on the mission. It's like, I never feel like it's my band, except for the fact that it's the band I'm in with these guys, you know, and it's one of those things that I get to really like. I ask them a lot of times if I'm going to take a chance on something, like on the last record with the State House song, we did a song, you know, dissing on the Proud Boys, you know, I wanted to make sure. I was like, well, you know, let me make sure that it's okay with you guys. Like, I don't want to put you in a spot that you don't want to be in. And I'm like, if that's the case, you know, I'll put it on my solo record. You know, I'll go play with another band. And these guys are cool, man. They're like, you know, they're people that are willing to stand by their values, and they take chances. You know, a lot of ways we're a punk band by ethos, you know, and not more by
than,
sound.
More than many punk bands who sound punk. You know, because it,
yeah.
for me, it's the attitude, and it's what, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything kind of thing. And
absolutely. That's 100%.
You guys are obviously, with those examples you just made there and many others over the years, you are willing to take a stand for what you believe to be right, despite whatever kickback that may get from, you know, outside sources. But I guess in some cases, maybe your own fan base as well sometimes.
Yeah, well, you know, I like to think that we cheer our fans on. We're very much a part of the world that we play for. And I feel like everybody needs, I think with the last record particularly, I felt like everybody needed a little bit of cheerleading and like a punch in the arm to say like, hey, I'm thinking about the same things you're thinking about. And it's cool. Like, we can talk about this. Like, let's, you know, don't keep your mouth shut out of fear, or don't think that you're just a loser. Like, you're not the loser, you know? And I think that this is what I get out of music and out of my social and art scene, is that people build me up and build my confidence up and give me the spirit to keep going. And I try to do that with, you know, particularly things got weird the past bunch of years. It's the moment, it's the time, you know? Like, I love that little, there's a little meme going around where it's like, it's like Joe Strummer or something like that. And it's like, he's saying like, this is the moment you've been practicing for, or this is what Joe trained you for, like something like that. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And again, that word for me, community, is when it really shines, you know, is when people show up for each other and stand up for what's right despite the consequences in some cases.
Yeah.
Does it ever get hairy out there on the road with a song like State House or you know, others you may have you ever come into predicaments that have risked physical safety?
I mean, there's definitely times when you know I might have to be a bit more diplomatic about something, or I'm wondering, like, as things are coming out of my mouth, I'm like, let's see what's going on in the crowd over there. We definitely get some looks. I mean, we had a couple of people, I remember one night in Vegas, maybe, you know, I said something or whatever, and just like the back, you know, a chunk of people in the back of the room, like, walked out like, oh man, slackers, man. Wow. Blah, 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 you know? And I was like, well, I guess, okay, cool. Good. I guess at least we know where you're at, you know? Mm-hmm.
There was a funny thing recently, Vic, where some guy was having a go at Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine. And he was like, stick to music, man. What do you know? And he's like, well, here's my Harvard degree in political science. and the guy was all mad. He's like, when did Rage Against the Machine get all political? And you're like, dude, have you been listening to the music all these years? And there are those people, too. It's so funny. They're like, what? The slackers are getting all political. It's like, well, duh.
No, I know. And we come from, I think we very much come from that two-tone lineage. But I mean, you go before that too. I mean, ska, reggae's been political since day one. It's a social, you know, you speak to your scene, you speak to your part of the culture. You tell stories that are true stories. That's one of the beautiful things about Calypso, that I think Calypso was the music. It was the news that they ain't going to put on the news. You know, you could talk about the local cops in a Calypso song and everybody would be like, ah, yes, I know who you're talking about. You know, it's the way to get the message across to everybody, you know. And when I think about how much good influence I got from music and from my music scenes, from going to shows, I learned so much about life. You know, I learned about how to relate to people. I learned about the real, my real politics, and not just the stuff that my parents told me or that school told me or whatever. I actually got to talk to people about real things, exposed to information that I wouldn't have got exposed to. You know, I try to continue that. I try to be like part of that. You know, what it's done for me, I try to keep doing for people, you know, because I know it's important, you know.
Well, that's you in a nutshell, my friend. You're a positive, you know, an awesome entertainer, but also just human being out there in the world. You know, there's a lot of people who I've come into contact with in this life who really live what they, you know, share on stage in their day to day life. And that, to me, seems like the essence of who you are and what you're all about, is not just to kind of walk the walk. Sorry, not just to talk the talk, but to walk the walk as well, and to really live it and be it, yeah, and pass it on.
Well, I'm a bad actor, so you know I can't fake nothing.
And where's home? Do you like, so for me, whenever I tour, I try and stay. So I'm in Australia right now. I only had a 5-day tour down here. Straight after the cruise, I hopped on a plane, came down here. And I just was like, well, I've got nothing to go back home for, so I'm just going to stay here and DJ for a few months. So I'm down here to the end of January. But you strike me as a free spirit as well. Like, are you someone who likes to move about the earth and, you know, just kind of like wherever you land, chill there for a bit, stay with friends, go traveling, exploring, wait till the next tour starts? Is that your life in some ways?
That is very much a good description of my life.
Love it. Love it. Well, that's inspiring to me to know that it's, you know, something that is sustainable and something that can feed your soul long term, you know, because for me, travel is everything, and meeting new people and just kind of experiencing different cultures and living in different places for periods of time. If you are someone that wants to grow and learn more about life, the best way to do it, you know, you can read all the books you want, and it's important to be educated, but only in really living it do we learn, I think, the meaning of life and it, all its rich, beautiful, and varied wonder.
That is 100% true, man. I took off from New York. I went particularly vagabond style in about 2018. I decided I was really going to just like, I'm not really going to go back anywhere, which I rarely did. I didn't do that much anyway. But then I was like, I'm going to pick a couple of places that I haven't put my attention towards. And a lot of that was in the Southwest of the United States. And what you're saying about, you can read books, but you can't get it until you go there. That's been my experience with the Southwest and with, that I would say that in particular, I really discovered a lot about that area and the people and, it kind of redefined a lot of the things I thought I knew. You know, I had to go back and research things and I talked to people and then I research, and then it's almost been like I've been going to school about America again. Like I had a whole history class.
Whereabouts are you talking when you say Southwest, like Arizona, places like that, or further south?
Yeah. So I wanted to concentrate on going across a lot of the Native American reservations. And I thought, before it's too late, let me actually take a look, like with my own eyes, talk to the people I know, play some shows, really look around. And little bits, little details, little information here, there. You start to put it together. And I was like, oh, wow. This is something they never taught me back home in school. I mean, I went to college. I took classes. I read books. There are things that they don't tell you in the books, and you see it. You see it in action. You see the people moving around. Just really interesting stuff. Like, You know, I had never connected, like, for example, I had never made the connection that, like, you know, Navajo people start, like, pick them as, like, Native American culture and Mexican culture, like, bam, right together. And I was like, oh, Mexicans are Native Americans. Like, duh. It's right there in front of your face the whole time. But nobody ever tells you that, you know? And I just actually heard an interview with Buffy St. Marie this morning. For some reason, they know what I like on the internet, you know? And she's saying she grew up in Massachusetts and people didn't understand that she was indigenous, that she was Native American. They kept telling her, what do you mean? They're all gone. They're all dead. They don't exist. And she's like, well, tell that to my relatives. They're there. They're living. They're alive. They have all the same feelings as you. And when I go down to the Southwest and I discovered all that and made all those kind of connections and then traveled through the South of the U.S. and even saw that reflected in places like Georgia and Virginia and Florida. And, you know, and I'm like, oh, I pieced America all back together in a different shape than it was 5 years ago for me. Like that's what travel does for me. And I 1,000%, if everybody got out and took a look around, it would be better for everybody, you know? Yeah.
I love that, dude. And presumably, you know, I was going to ask if you were documenting the experiences, but as you probably alluded to earlier on, is probably the case now as well. They'll be appearing as stories and songs and whatnot, but fascinating man. Fascinating. Would you ever do like a travel book or anything like that? A different form of documentation?
I'm always open for anything. I mean, I write a lot and I write in a lot of different styles, but yeah, I've never been really good at documentary writing or at a, narrative kind of stuff. I'm mostly songs, poems, little short form, you know. But yeah, whatever, you know. I mean, we do what we do to communicate. I communicate however I can communicate, you know.
Same. That's why I love doing these, man.
Yeah.
And
evolution of style here with podcasts has been a great thing for the world, huh?
Hasn't it? And just connection, yeah. and you know, as much as technology is the bane of my life in many cases, and I think it's eroded a lot of good stuff. The fact that I can sit here in Australia and talk to you over Zoom, that
incredible
magic and gift is not lost on me. And what I've been thinking a lot, which I'd like to kind of end on this note, thank you for an amazing chat, man. I knew it was going to be cool and insightful, and I hope we can do it again in person sometime. But I'd like to just end with throwing this idea back at you, because being down here and being in the headspace that I'm in and realizing everything that I have in my life and everything that I'm grateful for, it's all a result of music, you know. And getting to travel and work and sort of pay for my stay in places like Australia and America and all over Europe, like, music's such an amazing gift and is really the source of everything that's good in my life. I'm presuming that is the case with you as well. But what a gift it is to be able to travel and experience the world, because when you travel as a musician, a performer, an entertainer as well, you do see more often than not the positive side of humanity as well, because you're in town to bring light to the community. And so people are going to welcome you in with open arms, and, you know, you're going to get to experience the local flavors and cultures, perhaps more so than a stranger breezing into town. So, yeah, man, thank God or whoever for music, right?
Absolutely. No, I always say that when I come into town and play shows, I'm finding the people that I was going to be looking for anyway. You know, I'm playing the venue that I was going to be looking for, or the bar that I was going to hope to find, you know. And from there, they'll tell me about where to go to a bookstore or a record shop or what historical thing to see or who to talk to. It's a real gift to be able to do that and, you know, wander around in that capacity. Yeah. That's great.
Well, Vic, you're a gentleman, my friend, and I'm very pleased to have made a connection with you on the boat and further and deepen that connection today. And
really cool.
Any UK or European touring plans for next year? I hope so.
Yeah, we got a fall. We got a fall tour that we're planning to do. That'll be UK and Europe. And I'm always popping around. I'm sure in the midst of, you know, somewhere between now and then, I'll be over there playing solo gigs. I'm always making little records with people. I'm always doing different projects. So, you know, that's my life. You know, you Google my name, there are a whole bunch of different projects come up. So, you know, there it is.
and dates and dots on the map.
Yeah, and dates. Yeah, it's like, oh, I'm playing here, I'm playing there, doing this, doing that. It is really the way I enjoy, knock on wood, it's the way I enjoy my life the best. And, you know, as long as I can do it, I will happily do it. I'm glad that there's people out there that are enjoying what I do. That's a pleasure for me.
Hell yeah.
You know?
Yeah, man. Well, listen, I hope that we can adventure together sometime, someplace, somewhere.
Yeah, totally.
You know, whether that's a show or even just, you know, an experience. I've really enjoyed chatting to you, man. And
yeah, enjoyed it too. Thanks a lot, man.
Thank you for the music. And yeah, sleep tight. I guess, will you be staying up for a while, being the night owl?
I'll be up for quite a while.
The day's just getting started. Me too.
It's only 9:30.
I'm off to the beach. 12:30 p.m. here, so I'm off for a beach day.
Nice.
Loving it. Have a great Christmas, man. And I'm gonna put this out on New Year's Day. What better way to start the new year? So awesome. I'll send you a link when it's up, and yeah, you can share at your end if you so desire. And
yeah, cool.
Till
next
time,
man.
Vic.
Really cool.
Love and
respect. Thank you so much, man. Cool.
Cheers, brother.
Later.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.